Mr. Starr.
May it please the Court. Kenneth W. Starr on behalf of IDX Systems Corporation. This case comes out of the Western District of Wisconsin and brings before the Court three issues. The first, and we believe the most important, is the review of the District Court's determination and a grant of summary judgment that IDX had failed to identify its trade secrets with sufficient particularity or specificity. The second is whether the confidentiality agreement, the non-disclosure agreement, set forth in the licensing agreements between IDX and UWMF's predecessors and binding on UWMF is in fact violative of public policy or otherwise illegal as a restraint of trade. And the third is the dismissal on a motion to dismiss the common law counts, which we believe at all events survive, even if we are mistaken with respect to trade secrets. As to the first issue, the Court determined that our responses set forth in a response to supplemental interrogatory number one, coupled with Appendix A, which set forth confidential business information protected by the non-disclosure agreement, and then the narrative set forth in Appendix B, was insufficient. There is very little guidance in the case law in the context of software technology, but there is guidance from this Court, including most recently in the 3M case, building upon what this Court had determined in the composite marine case.
But Mr. Starr, I mean, the problem, I guess, that the District Court saw was that although IDX may have described the functions that its software performed in these nine categories initially, and then there would be other documents, anybody would know the functions. IDX appeared at trade shows. They touted the functions. There was nothing secret about them. And I think the Court was concerned with respect to your lengthy manuals that, at a minimum, you had not pointed it to the places where something worthy of being called a trade secret existed and said, you know, what am I supposed to do, read through 3,000 pages of manuals to figure it out? I mean, it's a big thing to talk about something as a trade secret in that it does impede competition.
If we had pointed to the manuals standing alone, I think there may have been an issue, notwithstanding the breadth of the language of this Court's opinion in 3M. But even if the Court does not read 3M, as I think it should be read, to say that one simply cannot point to a general area of technology and say there must be something secret there, the specific teaching of this Court in composite marine, the identification of the nine categories read as the enumeration of the categories quite specifically states in conjunction with Appendix B, which is a double-spaced 43-page narrative. And if I may point the Court at a high level of generality in light of this material being under seal to one specific example that we think makes the point and shows that, with all respect, the District Court was in error in this particular regard.
But before you do that, could I just ask whether you are then willing to agree that where the District Court states, in its opinion, these nine items are not trade secrets themselves, but rather are areas of trade secrets, is that an accurate statement in your view?
I disagree. We believe that the statement, I don't think we need to prevail on this, even if I don't convince you of the correctness of our position in this respect, then I would still say look to Appendix B, because what we were asked to do in the crucible of litigation was to please identify these specific categories of trade secrets. We think that the list responds to that.
Like invoice-level processing? Why is that a trade secret?
Well, Your Honor, you could take each one of these and say, well, in what way? I will point the Court, with the Court's permission, to a specific example. But may I notice the structure? May I notice this and call to the Court's attention the structure of the presentation in A? Perhaps it should have been a unified document with no Appendix B, but notice that it identifies, and this is consistent with trade secret law, given the breadth of the definition of trade secret. The key to a trade secret is its information, high level of generality, that then has competitive value in the marketplace, some value, and then that the owner of the trade secret has taken reasonable steps to protect. In the law of this circuit, the door through which one walks with respect to identification of trade secret is a very wide door indeed. One must, in fact, provide more than simply pointing to a general area of technology. But one can show, Your Honor, since recall what this system is, it is a very sophisticated and complex software system that, in fact, carries out various functions through what? The use of, and this is the structure now of the enumeration, concepts, designs, methods, and processes, and then identifying specific attributes and what those methods are, but then guiding the reader to the specific additional information in Appendix B. And if one looks, for example, to one category, real-time error checking of charges, category number 3, found at page 227 of the Joint Appendix. It identifies it. It describes it. We thought that was responsive to the district court's order. I should note, by way of parenthesis, that we have been provided no guidance. Even to this day, we have not been provided with, if I may say so, specific guidance in this context of how to be specific. But if you look to Appendix B, there is a 6-page discussion of real-time error checking, including one of the most important dimensions of this, which is the utilization of work files. And what the district court says, and this is the assurance to this court, that the district court, with all respect, misapprehended. It underread the submission. The district court said, this is at JA-15, the court finds no explicit discussion of real-time charge checking. Your Honor, that's wrong.
Maybe it is, but I guess I wonder if one could ask about the distinction between something like an operator's manual. You know, if I get Lotus Notes to work with on my computer, which sadly enough I just have, I have a notebook that tells me how I'm supposed to do it, and that tells me all kinds of things about what I do to make the program work for me, or supposedly make the program work for me. And then there's other documentation, all the way from source code on up to things that I would, sure, Lotus probably regards as either copyright protected or trade secret protected. How in fact do they make this program work? And it reminds me to take a rather simple example of somebody saying, you know, if you want to make this product, take two parts of A and three parts of B and mix them together in the following proportions, and it'll make the product that you want. That I can see easily could be a trade secret, because other people may not have figured out that that's exactly how you do it. So you keep it secret. Let's say it's not patentable or copyrightable. And I think what has the district court worried about is that what you've given it is a very elaborate description of how to make this system work, but nothing that tells you why it's working that way, and it's the why part that I thought it was looking for.
Well, I think if one reads the listing, and that's what we thought we were required to do, the listing and the opening, mm-hmm. and you couple that with the explanation, which does, in fact, as page 6, which is at page of the opening presentation, at page JA-230 and 231, it again points out, and this is a difficult area to describe in lay language, it's one of the challenges in litigation, and I would again point to this court's law, and I would say that your hypothetical went to the second part of the 3M case, Judge Wood, but the first part went to the assertion that simply identifying their manuals standing alone, which had public information and information such as how to clean around the machine. How could that, in fact, the defendant said, constitute a trade secret? And this court held, it was a unanimous panel, this court held that there was, in fact, in that a statement of the combination, and I think that is what is going on here. Each of these reflects a combination of functionality that we want to be able to prove up at trial.
Mr. Starr, is it your position then that if we look at Appendix A and Appendix B in their totality, that is sufficient, or do you have to take another step and actually look at the manuals?
I do not think you need to look at the manuals. Did the district court look at the manuals?
The manuals, yeah.
I do not believe the district court did. What happened?
They don't appear to be in the appellate record. We looked and I had trouble.
And I don't believe the district court had access to that. In terms of the procedure, the court said on May 16, and we're not quarreling with this, but just in terms of the timing and the dynamics of the litigation below, said on May 16, we need greater specificity. Fine. We submitted this on May 18. The litigation was being moved along. We really thought, in all sincerity, in light of Composite Marine and the law of trade secrets, that it had sufficed. We certainly think, in light of 3M, that this suffices. But no, the distinction, Judge Ripple, I would draw, and we were trying to be helpful, but in trying to be helpful and to be clear, the district court found that it was unnavigable. You've given me too much. But I think what we have made quite clear and what we tried to make clear in the district court, I note there was no hearing on summary judgment. It's not a quibble. The point is this is complicated stuff. It is easier in a deliberative process to say, Judge, this is what we have in mind. If this is not clear, we are anxious to provide whatever additional clarity is necessary. We're not resisting clarity.
You think it would have been a different scene if counsel had been able to walk the district court through this stuff?
I have no doubt. Or certainly I believe there's every reason to think that in these kinds of complicated cases involving intellectual property, not peculiarly to software, but especially with software where language may be a barrier to understanding, it would be good practice. I'm not suggesting this court require it, but it would be good practice. This is frequently employed to have a tutorial so that we know what we're talking about.
After the district court ruled on summary judgment, was any effort made to try again?
We did not, Your Honor. We filed our notice of appeal. Perhaps we can be faulted for not doing that, but the court was very clear that we had been given the chance to be specific, and a judgment was made that we should simply file a notice of appeal, because we felt again, and especially with the further enlightenment of 3M, that the law of this circuit is clear in that respect.
But I guess there are two levels of the question on this trade secret issue. One of them is, to what extent did you identify, so that the court could understand it or so that your opponents could understand it, the concepts, designs, methods, processes that you had, as opposed to the functionalities? This will send an email, this will do a spell check, this will do your invoices. And then that's part one. Part two is, to what extent had you shown that even the functionalities or whatever it is you were describing were subject to reasonable methods to keep secret? Your opponents make a big deal of the fact that, I guess on the UVA website and some others, a lot of this material that you say was secret was sitting out there for all to visit.
May I address that, Your Honor? There's no question. It appeared on a website, and while we did have a task force in operation, that had not been identified at the time, but prompt remedial action was taken. And I would say that I read in the Gazettes that even in Redmond, Washington, there are issues in software with respect to maintaining security. Leakage onto the Internet in the information age does, in fact, happen. That may raise an issue, and we look forward, if this court allows us, to litigating that and other issues in terms of were we sufficiently vigilant. We believe we were, but at a minimum, under the law of this circuit, that question of reasonableness is peculiarly one that's fact-intensive, this court has so held, and thus that, by all means, does not lend itself to disposition but summary judgment. If I may say just a few words about the confidentiality agreement. This holding of the district court is unprecedented in Wisconsin law. We think it is a remarkable step for a court sitting in diversity to make a determination that a widely utilized
Did anybody bring a ProCD case to the district judge's attention? I noticed that you haven't cited it either. but it's a case enforcing a confidentiality agreement with respect to software under Wisconsin law.
We have obviously misapprehended a case, and I apologize to the court. We have not served the court well if there is a case that we've failed to identify.
We're aware of proceedings. I was asking whether anybody brought it to the district court's attention.
And I'm not aware that it was. I'm not aware that it was. And I thank the court for identifying that. And obviously, we are chastened that we did not, in fact, bring it to the district court's attention, and I'm going to accept...
We're more chastened than your adversary because it helps you more than them.
Well, I'm especially chastened, however, because it does point. It sounds from the court's description as if it points to the important truth that, and I don't think it need detain us long, but I'm anxious...
I don't know whether it points to any important truth. We thought it pointed to Wisconsin law.
Yes, at which we think Wisconsin...
There's a difference.
We think, happily, in this instance, Wisconsin law is consistent with policy elsewhere, and it is sometimes said that justice is truth in action, and thus it does seem to us that Wisconsin law here only carves out an exception with respect to employer-employee agreements, and unless there are questions... with respect to that, we think that that dimension of the court's ruling is, especially in light of the learning that the court has now enlightened me with respect to, is wrong as a matter of law.
Could I ask you a more factually oriented question? Another point made by your adversaries is that just as you were not specific enough with the court with respect to the things that you claimed were trade secrets, you didn't explain to it well enough what information you thought fell in the category of confidential yet not trade secret.
Well, recall again, we in this context are in the context of a motion to dismiss, and the evolution, I'll be very clear, we think our manuals represent confidential information, confidential business information. And I think the complaint, if one returns to the complaint, one sees that the complaint draws its notice pleading, but it does in fact articulate both. We full well understand that there is information that we treat as confidential, but we may not be able to satisfy the burden that it is a trade secret. But it still is confidential, and it should not go through improper means, which is what this case is ultimately all about factually. These are wonderful legal issues, but the process by which this contract, which we understood we were going to receive, and IDX, if I may say so, and I don't think it's going to be disputed, is a leader in the industry, was taken away from us, and I refer the court in particular to the provisions in the portions of the joint appendix, noting the testimony of individuals such as Cliff Pulver, who talked about from the inside perspective what was going on. Improper disclosures, that's what's going on. Now, interesting issue.
How is the University of Wisconsin supposed to talk to competing vendors as it shops a contract like this if it doesn't at least say, this is what we like and this is what we don't like in the system that we're now using, what can you do about it?
The last part of your question raised a potential issue under the confidentiality agreement. I think the way the marketplace operates is this. You say, here is the kind of function that we would like to achieve. But what you do not do is take our proprietary materials, we think they're trade secrets, and take them and put them on the board, which is what the allegation is. We never had the chance to test it. You don't draw and say, well, we're not going to now give you a photocopy of this page, but we're now going to draw it on the board for you. This is exactly what IDX does. And the key here, Judge Wood, is that over this year and a half period of remarkable, one-sided, unusual, irregular tutorials, there were indications that Quaid and Rosencrantz made Epic, which did not have, this is, we believe, undisputed, but we'll litigate it if you give us the opportunity, did not have certain of our functionalities. And then after that year and a half process of gestation and incubator, as it were, they did then achieve those functionalities. Now, that process is one that goes wildly beyond a statement by a vendee as to what its legitimate needs are. And that's why, again, this kind of agreement is absolutely typical and commonplace in the industry. Moreover, Epic itself, in its agreement with UWMF, has such an agreement. There's no justification for for striking this down. And if the confidentiality agreement or the non-disclosure agreement survives, so then should our breach of contract claim, by definition, the last count of the amended complaint, as well as the other common law counts. And if I may, I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Starr.
I thank the court.
Mr. Seid.
May it please the court, Your Honor. My name is Nicholas C. I'm here on behalf of the defendant, Epic Systems Corporation. The multiple defendants in this case are arguing separately by topic. My topic is trade secret. Mr. Furlow will address the confidentiality agreement, and Ms. Nider will address the issues that are only applicable to the individual defendants. My client,
you're going to have to understand that we will ask you whatever questions we want.
I'm sure you will, and I'll try
division
to answer.
Division by subject of an oral argument is not a good way to proceed in an appellate court.
Advice taken, Your Honor. My client, Epic Systems Corporation, was sued for doing what any good company does, listening to its customers, talking to its customers to find out what they want. From the beginning of this case, our inquiry in this case has been focused on determining what this case is about. What are the trade secrets that are at issue here? I think the case law establishes fairly clearly that the burden is on the plaintiff to identify the trade secrets and distinguish them from the facts known to the world at large.
Mr. C., is it not at least a disputed fact that Epic, at the beginning of all of this, Epic System had a certain set of functionalities, and after the negotiations with University of Wisconsin were finished, it had a more elaborate, longer list of functionalities?
That is true. But none of the functionalities that are added have so far been identified by IDX as a trade secret. Mr. Starr, for example, identified real-time error checking of charges as a critical trade secret during his argument. You will find a declaration of Andrew Ma, the Epic programmer in charge of this project, in the joint appendix at pages 221 to 222, reciting how Epic had a functionality of real-time charge entry checking before it ever talked to UW.
Oh, I'm not challenging that everybody would agree, I'm sure, that there were probably some things before any of this started that both Epic and IDX did.
Correct.
They were in the same business. But I thought IDX's argument was that Epic found out what the additional things were that the IDX system did because of improper disclosures from University of Wisconsin personnel, and it fixed its program. So today, I suppose, if we looked at the Epic system, maybe they map on one another except for graphics versus
Your Honor, IDX has continually said that as if it's a proven fact. There's no facts in the record to support that. Yes, the Epic system was getting better. We make our software better. They have not identified one fact transmitted to them that was not previously in the Epic software that would fit the category you discussed. In fact, in the record below, we demonstrated that all the 9 trade secrets that they identified for us in response to the specific court order telling them to identify the secrets were publicly known. Mr. Starr just said that he disagreed that the trade secrets are public, that the 9 listed items. In their brief below, they said, all these systems, meaning Epic, IDX, and the competitors, must accomplish the same goals, the input processing and use of very similar data about patients, doctors, appointments, charges, etc. It's axiomatic. Competitors have similar systems that try to perform the same tasks. Joint Appendix 927. They admitted below that all of the 9 identified trade secrets were in everybody's software. Their brief is in our appendix, so that you can check this out. It's in the appendix at page 909. Below, they admitted to the trial court, yes, all of these 9 topics that you told us to identify are well known in the art and used by others. But there's something else that's secret.
But it seems to me that the logic of your argument might take us to the point that we would never recognize a trade secret in computer software that was above, let's say, the operational code level.
Your Honor, we didn't see their code.
I know you didn't, but I'm saying, can there ever be a case, in your view, where somebody has a trade secret in something that isn't source code or operational code?
Perhaps, sure. But there isn't one here. The absurdity of this position, let me illustrate the absurdity of IDX's position. They assert that anything and everything about their software is secret, and they make no effort to distinguish what's known to the public from what's not. For example, I brought a visual aid. I showed it to counsel for IDX before we started. They object to my showing it to the audience because it's in the confidential portion of their brief. I will show it to the court. I will not show it to the courtroom at large.
Everybody in the courtroom, please take off your X-ray goggles.
IDX said, I can't read this in the courtroom because it's a secret. However, this same secret is described in the IDX literature that they freely distribute to the world that happens to be contained in the joint appendix at page 537.
The public appendix?
The joint appendix filed by the defendants,
okay,
which was filed under seal, even though that particular document is a public document. They continue to assert that anything and everything about their software is a secret, and they make no effort to distinguish these alleged secrets from what's known to the world at large. As a plaintiff, you bear burden. We're defending this case. My client didn't see any of the things you would think of as normally secret. We didn't see their software. We didn't see the code. We did not see the manuals. The manuals are sitting in three boxes over there. They're about 8,000 pages of material. In their reply to the judge's order to name the secrets, IDX incorporated by reference 8,000 pages of material. Their position is that somehow the burden is on us to demonstrate that all the 42-page appendix and all the 8,000 pages are public, otherwise we cannot win on summary judgment. That's not the law. The law is it's their burden to come forward and identify something not known to the world at large that would survive summary judgment. That's the law in ECT, which is the applicable Wisconsin case. That, I believe, is the law of the Seventh Circuit. I'd like to point out particularly the IMAX case from the Ninth Circuit on a very similar topic. It was very similar to this case because, just like in this case, the plaintiff had been reprimanded several times by the trial court for being evasive about naming their trade secrets. At the time of the court's May 18th the court's order that resulted in IDX's filing on May 18th, IDX had already been found in violation of discovery orders twice for failure to answer simple questions about what are these secrets about. This item that I put on the board here is a topic. It does not describe the underlying secret. It's just like the sort of secrets that were at issue in IMAX, where, if you remember, IMAX responded by saying, our tolerances are secret, without ever saying what the tolerances were. IDX will identify topics they say are secret. They never tell us what the methods, procedures, processes, anything about what makes them work truly is secret.
But given that this is summary judgment, isn't the question for us whether they've presented enough to get to trial on the question whether in these meetings with University of Wisconsin, they were saying, boy, what we really like about IDX's software is that we can do the following five steps and we come up with a result that we like instead of 15, like we have to do in somebody else's program. And you said, oh, we'll whittle ours down to five, too, then.
But that's not what the record supports, Your Honor. In fact, the record establishes IDX relies heavily on the deposition testimony of a Mr. Pulver, who was a former UW employee.
He was the whistleblower, right?
He was the whistleblower. Mr. Pulver testified that there was no code given to IDX, there was no programs given to IDX, and there was one single algorithm described to IDX. That algorithm had to do with charge batch headers. Algorithm is a fancy word for procedures. He then admitted that that procedure, charge batch headers, is common in the industry and all the competitors use it. It's in the joint appendix, pages 954 to 957. Mr. Pulver's testimony specifically negated anything secret being transferred from Epic to UW, from UW to Epic. The UW people in these meetings were users, keyboard operators. There were two programmers present, Pulver and Bauman. Bauman has a declaration on the record saying, we never told anything to Epic that was confidential about IDX subject matter. And he was deposed by IDX. The only person who makes any allegation that something wrong was done was Mr. Pulver, and he freely admits that nothing of the type that you would think is secret, how the software works, how the code works, what the data structures were, any of those kind of things, were ever transferred to Epic. IDX wants to assert that what its software does, the broad functionality, is somehow secret, and then they show it to everybody. They freely admit that at any trade show, they show their software. In the record, as it happens, are photos of the IDX trade show booth at the HIMSS conference. It was about a year ago in 2 weeks. It's in the appendix at pages 668 to 670. In that appendix, at those pages, are color photos of the IDX software and screens. Yet they say that somehow what the software does is secret. How can they show it to everyone in the world who might buy their software and say that it's secret? It's as if I was a car manufacturer who wanted to say how my radio or air conditioning works was a secret, but anyone could come in the showroom and sit in the car and see how it works. I can understand their argument if there was some fundamental underlying principle that operated the software that they were trying to protect. But they've asserted broad areas of functionality about what the software does for the users, which they admit they show to all prospective customers. They've asserted that that somehow is trade secret. Again, I believe the decisive principle in this case is who bears the burden. The judge, as a matter of his discretion in managing the case, out of frustration with IDX's evasions on discovery and refusal to respond to appropriate discovery, ordered them to identify with specificity all, and I emphasize the word, all trade secrets. They submitted a list. The list had 9 items on it. When we went for summary judgment, we followed the local rule, which says propose a finding of fact and conclusion of law. We proposed a finding of fact that said these are the 9 secrets that the case is about. They filed a response that said, yes, it is. They filed a brief. They mentioned no detail about anything. They said there are other details about some of these 9 areas that are still secret without ever specifying a single one. You don't survive summary judgment doing that way.
Assume that the trade secret issue is resolved in your favor. What about the contract?
What about the contract? First of all, we weren't party to the contract.
You weren't party to the contract, but I assume there's potential liability for inducing the University of Wisconsin to breach its obligations.
If somehow we knew about their obligation, and I believe IDX was wrong about one point, our contract only protects trade secrets. It does not protect non-confidential information. Because we understand...
Why do you think trade secret is a synonym for confidential? All trade secrets are confidential, but all confidential things may not be a trade secret.
In Wisconsin, Your Honor, the law is fairly clear that you can't restrain employees beyond trade secrets. Kind of restraints are unreasonable.
But wait a minute. Does that mean that that my weight and height are a trade secret, even though I may regard them as confidential information? Resumes of employees are trade secrets?
Can you repeat the question? I didn't understand it.
I'm saying that although you can say that all trade secrets satisfy the criterion of confidentiality.
Correct.
You can't turn it around. You can't say all confidential information.
Correct.
Is automatically a trade secret because the test is different.
That's
and
true,
the
Your
contract
Honor.
Covers lots of most contracts cover confidential information as a broader category, a subset of which is trade secret.
Indeed, to take Judge Wood's example, if she were to give a prospective employer a resume under a confidentiality agreement saying that that would not be shared with third parties, that agreement was unenforceable as a matter of law in Wisconsin.
To employees of that individual, not to that individual.
Any third parties. Judge Wood gives the resume to a prospective employer, and the prospective employer, make it the University of Wisconsin, signs a contract saying, I promise I will not give this to any third party.
Correct.
Yours sincerely, the University of Wisconsin. Your view seems to be that that is, as a matter of law, unenforceable in Wisconsin because her resume is not a trade secret, and moreover, that a third party can induce breach of that contract by, say, paying the University of Wisconsin to turn it over.
Can I say what my position is? My position is that the contract viewed as a whole is unreasonable and that it has no other limitations on it. I believe the applicable Wisconsin Supreme Court...
I don't know what you mean by other limitations. It would
time, geographic...
Counsel, hold on. Okay. Time, geography. It would be absurd to say that the university can promise not to reveal her resume in Wisconsin, but can't promise not to reveal her resume in New York. Information doesn't respect state borders, and a confidentiality promise limited to the state of Wisconsin is worthless. So it comes back to the proposition that you're saying that as a matter of law, that hypothetical contract simply is utterly unenforceable.
I believe the Wisconsin law is that as applied to employees, it is unenforceable.
I don't know what it means as applied to employees. Corporations work through employees.
I understand.
There's no such thing as not applied to employees.
Your Honor, I read the Wisconsin case law. Remember, we're sitting in diversity. You're making a public policy argument why that rule should not exist. But I read
well,
the Wisconsin
you're making an argument that we should overrule Pro CD against Zeidenberg because we enforced confidentiality contract dealing with computer software under Wisconsin law.
There's a difference, Your Honor. In Pro-CD, the individual signed the contract. They were not employees. Wisconsin law says employees cannot be bound by such contracts.
I can't imagine a legal regime that says the University of Wisconsin could be bound by its contract, but every employee of the University of Wisconsin is free to disregard it. It would make no sense whatsoever.
May I yield on this issue to my colleague who was a party to the contract, which my client would not?
Unless you're saying that for some reason Wisconsin law does not recognize inducement to breach, this concerns you as well as the university.
But we did not have notice of this provision. We were told that the university was taking safeguards appropriate to its contract. IDX would impute to us knowledge that everyone in the industry...
Wouldn't one infer from the curious behavior of the university saying, we can't show you screenshots, but people will draw it from memory, that there might be an underlying contract?
Well, we knew there was an underlying contract. We had no idea what its confidentiality provisions say.
Mm.
And our contract only protects trade secrets, unlike theirs, which we understood to be standard in the industry. They disagree.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fee.
Thank you.
Mr. Furlong.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. John Furlong on behalf of the University of Wisconsin Medical Foundation. I'd like to tie up a couple things and then talk about the contract because I can't address that specifically. Number one, IDX is not an industry leader. They are not. Number two, it is an undisputed fact on this record that before a single one of these meetings took place that seemed to be the source of these disclosures that keep getting talked about, it is undisputed that the IDX package was scored higher. Excuse me, the EPIC package was scored higher than the IDX package.
What does any of this have to do with this litigation?
Well, I just respond to the response by counsel that somehow IDX was the industry leader and the only way to get...
If the Apple operating system scores higher than Microsoft, does that mean that Apple can't have taken any of Microsoft's trade secrets or the reverse?
It doesn't at all.
This is completely irrelevant. Please get to the merits of the case.
The question on the contract is this. We're not talking about software licensing contracts generally. We're not talking about a shrink-wrap contract where you get a product attached to an agreement.
We usually think shrink-wrap contracts are worse than individually negotiated contracts.
Well, in this particular...
No argument that you were bound by some sticky contract of adhesion. These are contracts between intelligent, well-represented, large institutions.
In fact, Your Honor, that is true. And these contracts entered into about 14 years ago are on their face limited to trade secrets. That's the natural reading. That is the reading that IDX put on the contract below.
That's a possible understanding. Then we wouldn't be having this dispute.
That's correct.
But what the district court held is that if not limited to trade secrets, they are invalid as a matter of Wisconsin law. And that's what led to Judge Wood's hypothetical and my question, and of course now to Epic's statement, that as a matter of law, no confidentiality agreement is enforceable in Wisconsin because every corporation acts through employees, and no agreement can bind employees.
I think I can make the problem a little bit easier. These particular contracts...
That's an easy proposition. It's just absurd.
Well, in Wisconsin, I'd point to Tagge versus Chamber on non-disclosures with employees as to be the Wisconsin controlling law. But these particular contracts basically say everything IDX provides the foundation in any form whatsoever is secret forever. That's what the contract says if you read it beyond trade secrets. Now, every case that IDX has cited, and I would suppose, but I don't know the Pro-CD case, I apologize, I suppose that case also could be read to say that there are limits usually. There's a limit in the subject matter. For example, with a shrink wrap, you give somebody software.
The limitation is to the licensed software.
Yeah,
it's the same limitation here. It's to the licensed software.
And it's a factual question. I mean, you're criticizing IDX for not taking vigorous enough efforts to protect the secrecy of its information, but a company that wants to keep everything that it gives to somebody else confidential probably starts out by saying, if we've given it to you, you have a contractual obligation to treat it as confidential, and then if it turns out there's leakage somewhere or there might be an affirmative defense in a breach of contract case that it was actually something that the New York Times publishes every day, or what have you. But it doesn't strike me as surprising that they would say such a thing if they're trying to protect their proprietary rights.
True enough, Your Honor, but in this case, the contract isn't even limited to what they provide us. Section 13.2.2, we cannot use, disclose, or divulge to others any data or information relating to the operating system or application software and or technologies, ideas, concept, know-how, etc. Anything relating to it.
But you know, isn't that something designed to capture the fact that, as you've stressed in another context, the University of Wisconsin, over the years, you know, modified and developed, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of a grant back clause in a patent license, where you're trying to make sure that the subject matter of the contract is protected, so you don't want to protect only a one-way flow of information, you want to protect a two-way flow.
Well, again, there's no question about that, but the question is, what does it mean and is it enforceable? And according to IDX's own expert below, their own expert says what is public information in this contract prohibits the foundation from discussing or disclosing public information. I'll give you an example. Their expert says below, in trade shows and general sales promotional brochures, this is Mr. Michael's report, it includes information that compellingly describes what the product is capable of doing and the benefits that accrue to a user by virtue of effective deployment. That is publicly available information that IDX freely discloses in trade shows and marketing presentations.
Mr. Perlow, you make a good argument that the contract is probably overbroad. But if it is overbroad, does that prohibit its enforcement with respect to those matters that are clearly within a permissible ambit of a non-disclosure agreement?
As to trade secrets, it would certainly apply. As to whether it applies to something else, IDX has never argued that point below, nor, even though it was their summary judgment motion, did they ever suggest to the court what might be included. They took the all-or-nothing approach. And having taken that approach below, it seems to me they are now in a position where they can't re-argue.
Taking that approach, their brief on appeal, at least, says that a major purpose of a clause like this is to protect information that might or might not be trade secrets, but it might be hard to show to a court's satisfaction that it's trade secrets. I don't read them as saying in their appellate brief that they view this clause as covering only things that they can prove to a court's satisfaction are trade secrets.
No, they read it much broader, and the question becomes, if we can't get to trade secret specificity, what does confidential information mean?
Are you also taking the position that there is no such concept in Wisconsin, that there's confidential information that's not a trade secret?
I suspect, Your Honor, there are things that may be confidential information that don't rise to the level of trade secrets.
And if that's true, I mean, I think that's actually quite clearly true under the law of Wisconsin, but I'm happy to be proven wrong about that. But in any event, if that's true, then parties who are trying for a private ordering, they're trying to write a contract that will protect them, may very well, precisely to avoid the kind of debate that Judge Easterbrook is talking about, try to cover just confidential information to avoid litigation about the edges of trade secret law. Sometimes they'll do that in patent licenses as well, where you're not sure what the scope of the patent was, so you say that it's going to cover the patent plus associated know-how, trade secrets, etc.
And in every case, Your Honor, in that circumstance, the contract will have a carve-out, whether it be public information, already available information, or relate to specific information.
Well, that gets back to Judge Ripple's question, I think.
And this contract, as it is written, cannot be enforced. It is vague. No one knows what it means if you go beyond trade secrets. And you can't put a vendee in that position when it affects competition as it does in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perlow. Ms. Snyder.
May it please the Court, I'm Barbara Nieder, and I'm here to make just 2 points on behalf of Mitch Quaid and Mike Rosenkranz. If the Court is inclined to remand this case to the District Court, we'd ask that the Court take the step of dismissing these two gentlemen on summary judgment. The District Court didn't need to reach that issue because they were dismissed along with the other defendants. But there's no evidence that either one of these gentlemen disclosed the secrets. IDX asks you to infer that the secrets were in fact disclosed. Mr. Pulver, the whistleblower, can't recall what Mr. Quaid said in the conversation in which he supposedly disclosed these secrets. You can't infer. It's not a reasonable inference to say, gosh, if Mr. Pulver could recall, Then he would probably recall that Mr. Quaid disclosed trade secrets, all of the details, the inner workings of the system. Surely that's something that would stick in his memory, but he's got no recall of that. As to Mr. Rosencrantz, the same thing is true. Mr. Pulver says he disclosed information about Hess found charge entry. But then if you read further in his deposition, he acknowledges that none of the information Mr. Rosencrantz gave to EPIC was confidential or proprietary. So there's simply no evidence that these gentlemen disclosed. I'd ask the court not to change the standard on summary judgment, as IDX suggests, for trade secret cases simply because there's confidential or circumstantial evidence that needs to be considered. There's nothing in Rule 56 and nothing in the case law that suggests that a different standard ought to be applied in those circumstances. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ms. Nutter. Anything further, Mr. Starr?
Very briefly, by way of clarification, the manuals are in the record. They're not in the JA. And they can be found at the record. They are in CD form, 80, 81, 83 to 85.
I take it you won't support our posting them on the court's website.
We would prefer that it not, Your Honor, consistent with this court's orders.
Did the district court have that material?
The district court did have the material, so I apologize for by not having been clear topside. On the confidential information or non-disclosure agreement, the pivotal, and we could all redraft the language was drafted some years ago. We're not going to suggest this is state of the art, but that has nothing to do with whether it's enforceable or not. And the key is, and a very sophisticated party, which has a very large practice involving literally hundreds of physicians, agreed, and this is the pivotal point. Could it be more artfully worded? Of course. But is it clear that what is being protected in the agreement on the part of UWMF and its predecessors is what we furnish to you? And then it identifies it, the operating system documentation.
In other words, everybody in the datamation business knows you don't give the opposition the manual.
That's
basically what amounts to.
That's exactly right. You don't just turn this over. And in that regard, on Quaid and Rosencrantz, I think it's very important in light of the tortious interference for us to note, in addition to the issue of trade secrets, we dispute that in terms of what they did, the Cliff Pulver testimony which we referred to, but I also would guide the court to pages 779 and 80 of the joint appendix. This is evidence in the record with respect to the pressure and harassment of UWMF employees who wanted to remain with IDX, as well as the letter, which I think is quite a revealing letter to the UWMF board from Mr. Pulver that is found at 780. That letter demonstrates the breadth of the concern that goes to our common law counts.
But for your common law counts, would you agree that you can't bring a tortious interference claim insofar as you are, in fact, relying on trade secrets? Given the language of the
Well, recall the carve. I'm sorry, forgive me.
No.
Remember the carve out and displacement. The displacement does carve out contractual type remedies.
Right.
So that is.
So you're not really saying tortious interference. You're saying tortious interference with the contract and the contract remedy?
No, it is in tort, but I think there is, because of the existence of a contract, it raises a very important issue under the displacement provisions of WTSA, which is only what is the trade secret panoply of remedies with respect to misappropriation. Our claim goes considerably beyond that and doesn't include confidential information. One final point on the law of the circuit. In Composite Marine, it is important to note what the court said and what it did. I have noted what the court said. It is not enough to point to broad areas of technology and assert that something there must have been secret and misappropriated. Then what did the court do? The court went through 8 categories of information at a level of generality, that is, they were stated at a level of generality that this court described as exceedingly general. But the case was not knocked out on the basis of lack of specificity. IMAX is a patent case, and this court also taught that greater specificity is required in the patent context. We're in software. We're not in the world of IMAX. I thank the court for its attention.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Starr. The case is taken under advisement.